Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The Four Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The Four Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, KEYS. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
Everyone thinks that if they achieve this certain status or money or fame or a TV show or a big podcast or a great album or a film like I did or whatever, that that will heal and absolve these wounds and create like a certain solve to minimize that shame or lack of self-worth. And I think that's like, there's a healthy aspect to that, that forces one to become a creator or creating on some level. But I realized, and partly why I satirized fame in the film, was I had to like take the piss out of it all. Like I had to look at that, which I thought would heal me in a way creatively or notoriety wise, and because I knew that wasn't going to do it, even though I was craving it because of this wound. So I had to get really honest with it and satirize it, because I know that deep down, that's as big of a mirage as anything.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com.
Doing creative work can be kind of lonely, and that's why we built the Unmistakable Listener Tribe. The Tribe is a community for professionals to connect and support each other. Everything is designed to help you grow your business and share what's working and what isn't. And that's true whether you're a business owner or an artist. You'll get access to feedback, live conversations with guests, and so much more. By joining the Tribe, you become part of a community of creators who all support each other, and it's completely free. Hopefully I'll see you there. Visit unmistakablecreative.com/tribe to join. Again, that's unmistakablecreative.com/tribe. Justin, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thanks for having me, Srini.
Yeah, it is my pleasure. So I found out about your story because you wrote in about your film, The Golden Age. And I think that the thing that really struck me was that you wrote about this idea of this obsession that we have as a culture with fame, which I thought this is kind of a no-brainer to me because it's so important, because I think that often we've, you know, prioritized, you know, fame over mastery and craft. But before we get into all of that, I want to start by asking you, what is one of the most important things that you learned from one or both of your parents that influenced and shaped who you've become and what you ended up doing with your life?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. Well, I think, you know, it's crazy. Our parents, I think, came from a generation where they kind of did what they felt that they had to do, but didn't necessarily want to do. You know, they're, you know, of course, having a traditional family. My father was an attorney. My mom was like a dance teacher. But secretly, my mom always wanted to be a singer. My dad was this really great saxophonist, and they both loved jazz. And the irony, and I talk about it a little bit in this book that accompanies the film that I'm releasing later this fall, is the irony is I became like the hybrid of what they really wanted to do in a generation where they couldn't. My dad wanted to be a musician. My mom wanted to be a singer. And it's like I became a hybrid of what they wanted to do, which was kind of strange. But I've learned so much from them, especially like my love of music. Like my dad was an incredibly large Beach Boys fan. And as a kid, I just couldn't stand listening to that damn music. But I realized... You know, I didn't realize Brian Wilson's genius as a child, and now I realize how much Brian Wilson's affected my life and how important they are in my life. And it was almost like I had to go through all this crazy tutelage with my father. He was like an alcoholic and abusive. You know, I got into it into the film a little bit, but it was like, he was training me, you know, with all these jazz records and the Beatles and, you know, all these different bands, but especially the Beach Boys. And it's like, I get so obsessed in recording and with all the production stuff. And I can't just make a regular album. It's like, oh, here's me on piano singing. It's like, I have to do my Brian Wilson. And I realized that was kind of the madness of being raised by my father. It was like, he was training me for something that I didn't even know. That's what's so funny about like karma or understanding fate in some respect. And my mom was just such a joy to be around. And I feel like I've gotten all of their best qualities, but we also get our parents' worst qualities too, you know? I was really inspired by how passionate they were about music. And you know, my father, I reconnected with him after 25 years of being estranged from him. I wrote about that in the book as well. And I talk a little bit about my relationship with him in the film, but you know, he was on his deathbed and he was like, couldn't move. And his final parting words to me the last time I saw him before he passed away was like, never give up, you know? No matter whether you're laying here like me and I can't get out of bed, he's like, never give up. Like, keep going. And it was really poignant because he was kind of like a little bit of a workaholic and this kind of Irish Catholic, you know, second generation immigrant from Ireland. And he really taught me about hard work. And I've become a little bit of a workaholic, especially in regards to the film, wearing a lot of hats. But there was and that can be, you know, not great for one's path. You know, you want to kind of have a balance in life, which I'm starting to learn to have more. But, you know, I got this work ethic from him that amidst whatever I had to go through with him, I'm so, so very grateful for it, because there's a real joy in work. And I think I wouldn't have had the ability to make this film or do anything I do creatively or just in life in general, because I'm such a fastidious worker and planner and executor. And I love that. You know, so I'm really grateful to both of them for those qualities, especially just their love of music, you know.
Yeah. You mentioned that, you know, your dad was an alcoholic, you became estranged from him. And yet, you know, in reflecting on this, you seem to have what appears to be an overwhelmingly positive, you know, outlook on the impact that he had on your life. So I'm curious, you know, one, you know, where does that rifts begin? But more importantly, what did you guys do to heal it? And how did you learn to forgive, you know, whatever pain he caused you?
Oh, geez. Wow. Yeah. Cause in the film, I really laid it out there that he was kind of like the antagonist of the film. And he was, you know, I had a really, really tough childhood with him. He was, I think, in pain. Maybe it was in part because he didn't follow his path the way he wanted to, whether it was music or something else, and kind of got forced into law, something his dad was a big, big judge back in the day. But, you know, it took some therapy. It took some introspection. I was estranged from him for a lot of years. There was a lot of abuse when I was growing up. And, you know, part of it, I think, is part of the devotional path that I explore a little bit in the film is once you hone in on, I mean, for me, the teachings from the East and a lot of my gurus from the East, they teach us about how this life that we're leading, it's very easy when you go through these trials and tribulations and have to walk through the fires, either with their parents or with a lover or someone that beat you or abused you or, you know, ups and downs of life, that this is part of our own karma, a part of our own fate. And it's very easy to have this perceived antagonist that's keeping us down and ruining us of sorts. But really, this is just a manifestation of that which needs to be settled of sorts. So that's really kind of relieved it on some level. Like, it's very easy to point the fingers at both my parents for something that lasted a lot longer than most children could have survived. And I'm surprised today that I'm still alive here talking to you right now, given my past. This went on for many years and it was chaotic. And I've had to do a lot of work to engender that forgiveness for him. So once I finished the film, that helped allow room for me to forgive him. And I met with him after 25 years and we, you know, had a little bit of a shouting match. But by the end, he told me how much he loved me and he was sorry. And it was, you know, forgiveness is the only way to really heal those wounds. But you can't forgive unless you can also forgive yourself for, or at least, you know, learn how to take protection and take care of that younger child self, because there's a real broken part of myself from the past. So I had to really like nurture this old, this younger kid in myself that I think is hurt that they weren't able to parent themselves. So a lot of it comes from forgiveness. And that's really tough with someone who like for years tried to ruin me. And, but when you forgive, it allows that other person to forgive themselves, or at least take a reflective image of their own madness so that they can try to build that up within themselves. So the last few years of my father, he became like my best friend, and I was ruined when he passed away. And I never would have guessed that prior to making this film. I was like, I'm never going to talk to this guy again. I mean, he really went out of his way to ruin my life, and I'm really hurt by it, because we're like sponges as kids, you know? I mean, I knew he had an alcoholic, you know, he was dealing with alcoholism, but the sad thing is, but the revelatory part of this whole conversation is his father, from what I gathered and understood, was 1,000 times harder than him than he was on me. So it was really like, it was, even though I was hurt by what had transpired, I felt more sympathy and forgiveness of wanting to heal the little boy in him as much as the little boy in me. You know, he couldn't come to terms and heal in the way that he had been hurt. And I think he carried that out with me. So it was an element of like fortitude and strength to say, I'm going to break this cycle for him and for myself. And once I was able to do that and really confront him on it, and he took it into his heart, we became like best buds. And it was almost like the past never even happened. You know, it was almost like we were erasing my past with him and his past with his dad. But it all comes from engendering a deep sense of love, humility, forgiveness, and respect for the madness of material life. And just really, so I kind of had to act like the healer in it, even though I was the most wounded, or it felt like, but I wasn't the most wounded. He probably was. So it took this big, like, metaphysical stare at myself and going through therapy and, you know, really trying to work on the fact that I had been through the ringer, but not nearly to the extent that he was. So I had to take a higher lens, because I knew he didn't have the skill set in which to do so.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now, with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
Yeah. You know, the thing that I think struck me even more about what you said is, I mean, your dad was an attorney, and it's like typically attorneys are, you know, pretty well to do. And typically the kinds of situations you've been in are, you know, ones in which people come from low income families. At least that's my perception. So what I wonder is, you know, when we see somebody like you, like, what do we overlook, or how do we, you know, sort of just, you know, miss something like this happening? Because I mean, just out of curiosity, did you grow up in difficult economic circumstances too?
No, it's quite the opposite. But you'd think like, oh, this kind of happens with people who are like not as well to do or whatever. But abuse, physical, emotional, sexual, all of it, that happens in every household, irrespective of economic status. You know, these stories happen to an extent far grander than you'd think. And I had maybe had the same, not misconception, but the same belief as well. And in many respects, I had a beautiful childhood. You know, it's so funny because even when you go through these traumas, those are the things that stick out because we're like sponges, and those are the things that palpably affect us the most. So it's hard for those not to override the positive experiences. But we had this nice beach house, and we did have some lovely holidays together before things went sour and all that. But it's, I think these happen in well-to-do families, middle-income families, you know, low-income families. I think it happens across the board. So my mom and dad got divorced when I was like 7, but the divorce proceedings in court, him being a lawyer, lasted till I went off to college. And wow, they never ended. And I was doing joint visitation with him, and he was getting drunk. It was very abusive. But I knew this was part of his own pain. And in regards to him being a lawyer, like, his dad was the son of an Irish immigrant. And his dad became like the first federal judge, the first Irish Catholic Democrat to get appointed as a federal judgeship. So he was like a big deal. So my dad felt the pressure to be an attorney from his dad, who was so tough on him, versus pursuing music. So it was like, and I was thinking of going to law school, to college. So it's like I had to break the cycle to follow my true inclinations in a way my dad maybe didn't have the opportunity to, because his father was even worse towards me. And what's even crazier than that, when you think about this play on karma, my mom and dad, you know, I think had a really deep, profound love for each other. And I think music was what bound them on some level. And, you know, they were warring at each other for years. They were at war. Then my whole childhood was like a battleground, and I was like a soldier or like a pawn in this very strange battle. And going in and out of court and going to see him in joint visitation, it was nuts. But to bring that karma play back into the conversation, my mom passed away just as I went into post-production on this film on my dad's birthday. And my dad, just as I was doing right before prepping for distribution, he passed away on her birthday, which sounds crazy. And I would tell people this, like, what? And I'm like, yeah, I know. But that's it was almost like even in their parting from this earth and their disappearance from their body, they were teaching me something about love, about the sanctity of, like, you know, that this material life is kind of a game if we can see it in a different context. It's no different than doing a film or a stage play and wearing a different costume. Like, I had some karmic stuff I had to go through with them to pay off. Maybe they had been my children in another lifetime. I don't know, but it was palpably intense. But I just thought it was a very, it was like their last parting gift to me was leaving this body on each other's birthday. So it was like, you know, I engendered a lot of forgiveness towards my dad. Not as much. I mean, for sure, for all the abuse and what he had put me through and my brothers through, but it was more like, think about that. If you really wanted to do whatever it is you wanted to do, but you felt pressure to do something that your dad did and you had to do that. I mean, that would cause a lot of misery. And I think a lot of that generation followed through on careers or beliefs or expectations, sometimes even just having a family and kids where they wanted to do something more risque. Whereas in our generation, it would be unheard of not to pursue what we want to do in a way that they didn't have the option to. So I think that's where I engendered a lot of forgiveness towards him, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. So did you ever tell anybody, like a social worker or anything like that? Or, and you know, why don't people tell somebody when this happens?
Well, this is where it gets tricky. First of all, my dad was a very tricky lawyer, a very good one, and told social workers, therapists, people knew about it, told the judges, but he worked with all the judges in courts. So he kind of had a little bit of a different angle and or favoritism, perhaps, in the legal system. A lot of our attorneys that we hired were afraid to take him on because he was so intimidating. And, you know, what's interesting about relationships and why I've kind of been on the sidelines for a while, not in one, is it's really important. You know, I don't know who said it, but, you know, the person you marry or end up with as part a long-term partner is like one of the most important decisions you'll make in your life, because on some level he was so sadistic in the battle and was untruthful in court. And, you know, it's easy to see as like, oh, my mom and him were, my mom was trying to resolve it. My dad was being vindictive. That was basically the long story of it. But if you flip it, and now that I have a little bit of distance from it, even though, yes, we told social workers, therapists, et cetera, and we had all the evidence in court, but we were kind of had the deck stacked against us with lawyers that were intimidated by him, as well as him knowing everyone in the courthouse at which we were, you know, going to court with in terms of the judges, et cetera, is really now that I pull back and take like a wider lens of this whole thing, I could really see that my mom, my dad, even amidst that, were deeply in love. And for whatever reason, it didn't work, probably in regards to my dad's alcoholism. But it was easy at the time. It was like, oh, this is happening because they hate each other. And it's like, well, if you do the flip side of it, it's like, you know, I say in the book, in the opening of it, in the intro is, it's a thin line between love and hate. That song is like the soundtrack to aptly describe my parents' plight. So even amidst what was going on, I think it was really reflective of how much they loved each other. And maybe it couldn't work out because my dad didn't have the strength or wherewithal to escape this career. I'm not sure he ever wanted to do, and used alcohol as a way to pacify the madness. But I saw it as all that warring back and forth as like a deep love that they were both wounded from it and then tried to, like, I don't know, maim each other, if that makes sense, in the aftermath.
Yeah, you mentioned being, you know, kind of on the sideline when it comes to relationships because of this. And that actually kind of made a perfect segue to my follow-up. How did your relationship with your father end up affecting your relationship with your mother, as well as your relationship with other people in your life?
Ooh, jeez, God damn, this is like going to be like a therapy session.
I've been known to do that to people.
No, thank you. These are good questions. Damn. Well, my relationship with my mom got skewed because it was hard to discern whether she was protecting us or she wanted to combat him and give him a taste of his own medicine. So it was like very hard trying to figure it out. It was like my brothers and I were like kids, but it was like we were the parents while this was all going on as young children, because we could see how vindictive and crazy this all is. So my relationship with my mom was affected by it because we kept asking her, can we just walk away and move away from this? Like, we were trying to move to California, but it was like this, you know, we're trying to get some settlement, but my dad was never going to settle because they were steeped in vindication. So it got really ugly with my mom. And I think she tried to take him on in a way she wasn't prepared for. And I think it kind of ruined her. And I think that was my dad's plan, of which he told me he was going to do from a very young age. So it was like he set out to do something. We told her and she couldn't see that he was doing it while it was happening. So that was hard. And it made me feel a little unsafe around her, as well as, of course, being unsafe around my father because of his sadistic abuse. But in terms of relationship with others, I think when you go through some intense shame and pain, well, really, you know, abuse and trauma, you inherit a sense of shame, whether you like it or not. And there are different levels to this game, but, you know, more often than not, you know, the more intense or the longer duration of it, the deeper levels that you have. And mine lasted longer than most. I really shouldn't be alive on some level after, you know, telling people the real deal story. But I'm grateful because it was heavy. It went so long. And so with other people in terms of relationships, whether it was partnerships or, you know, romantic relationships and such, when that shame is so thick, if you don't process it, it's impossible to be in a relationship. So what gets incurred from shame is it's not even really the inability to love someone. I'm always like, I'm like a great boyfriend. But what frustrated so many women that I was with was I was unable to accept their love because that shame was so deep in terms of that worth, that like self-worth thing. And I think a lot of artists have some kind of fractured past, which is what makes them want to create. And that's what makes their art and their creation so interesting and beautiful, because it's coming from a place of there was some fracture there. They're trying to put the pieces back together. So I'm cognizant of that. Yet at the same time, I really had to nurture that kid in myself and rebuild that ability to say, yeah, I'm worth being loved, you know. But it gets very sinuous in terms of how deep that those strains of that bedrock of your own like foundation can get cracked. That if you don't go through and process this stuff, you'll never, whatever it is you'll do, you'll never feel enough. And it's like, we see a lot of people doing that out in culture now in terms of being famous or social media. And everyone thinks that if they achieve this certain status or money or fame or a TV show or a big podcast or a great album or a film like I did or whatever, that that will heal and absolve these wounds and create like a certain solve to minimize that shame or lack of self-worth. And I think that's like, there's a healthy aspect to that that forces one to become a creator or creating on some level. But I realized, and partly why I satirized fame in the film, was I had to like take the piss out of it all. Like I had to look at that, which I thought would heal me in a way creatively or notoriety wise. And because I knew that wasn't going to do it, even though I was craving it because of this wound. So I had to get really honest with it and satirize it, because I know that deep down, that's as big of a mirage as anything. So that's where it kind of came from. And I think in relationships now, I'm feeling like ready to get back out there and get back in one when that's time, you know, when it's fate steers that my way. But I think it was challenging, and partly, you know, we all kind of date the wrong people on some level for many years until we realize we're not. I think there's also elements where we can't help but be attracted to aspects of our parents because that's how we were raised and we're sponges. And I don't know anybody that doesn't date their parents on some level. So, you know, I mean, I think that's pretty apropos. So I'm now cognizant of what I was once attracted to. And I realized that those archetypes, as well as with friends, that those archetypes are very reflective of the archetypes at which I was raised, hell or high water, even if it's the worst thing for me. So now I'm like attracting a different vibration of person because of the work I've done. And I think that that's where I'm excited in terms of where I move forward from here. But it took a long, arduous process. And I'm not, and there's a lot of people in my family that can't do the same or are still steeped in denial about it. And God bless them for wherever they are on their path. But for me, it was like I was suffocated until I addressed this. So I had to confront not only my longings for fame and whatever, thinking that would sort of heal these wounds, hence me satirizing it, as well as really getting honest and really like gangster deep about how wounded I was. And that's a painful admittance to oneself, and that's a painful admittance to the world. Because I would never, I never wanted to make a film and be like, "Hey, here's what I've been through. What do you think?" Like, I didn't want to like just put all my stuff out there, but I felt like I had to be so viscerally honest about what I had been through, even though it was so uncomfortable. It still is to this day, knowing that I put it out there, because I felt like that was the only way I could heal from this, is by slaying the beast, by being gutturally transparent and honest in a way that still frightens me to this day.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Yeah. So one last question about this, and then we'll start getting into the actual work and really deep diving into this whole idea of fame.
Sure.
Did you yourself ever turn to drugs or alcohol as a byproduct of this?
A little bit. There are other people in my family tree who have been steeped with alcoholism, but fortunately I missed that strain, and that shows up in different siblings usually when amidst these situations. But you know, I can drink occasionally and be fine with it, but I don't normally drink anymore. I struggled with cigarettes for a lot of years, and I think that was, from what I've learned, like in the lungs, that's where we hold our grief. So a lot of smokers, you know, have some, no, I'm not saying all across the board. I mean, nicotine is so damn addictive, but a lot of smokers, from what I've read and discussed with them and read about, is that, you know, we hold these like gobs of grief in our lungs. So we want to kind of anesthetize ourselves from feeling them, or feeling those wounds. And that's what I felt like I was doing for a lot of years. And, you know, I played around with psychedelics and done all kinds of things and ayahuasca and all that stuff. So, I mean, yeah, there's always like a dipping of my toe into that water, but I've never felt like, oh, I need these things, or I've had a strong addiction. If anything that I became addicted to is what I, alluded to earlier with my father. If I have like one Achilles heel, it's a double-edged sword. it's my saving grace and it's my denouement fall down. And that's workaholism. And there's no way, if I hadn't become a workaholic, having witnessed my dad and programming into me, right or wrongly, hell or high water, whichever way, you know, like, don't be a bum, work hard, never give up, you know, like, instill this work ethic in me. That was kind of like, I had to take a look at that too, because that can be an escape from living a balanced life, from having a healthy relationship, or being an obsessive careerist, or wanting to show everyone what you can do, or becoming a perfectionist, or controlling, you know, like, all those themes come into that workaholism. So it's my greatest asset. There's no way I would have been able to make this film and wear as many hats if I didn't have that. But at the same time, that can be an Achilles heel far more than any drug could ever be. And now that the film is, and I'm promoting it, outside of that, it's like rediscovering my life, even though I know there's a million other projects I'm ready to take on next. It's like, I really have to step back and almost like reconfigure and reformat my life like you do like a hard drive on your computer, because I've been working with to-do lists and going, you know, 90 miles an hour for so many years, maybe since I was a kid, that I'm now learning to slow down and being like, it's okay to take a step back from that, because workaholism maybe isn't, although it feeds me in many respects, it can also kind of be not only my Achilles heel, but it might kill me if I do it to the same extent I've been doing it my whole life.
I think I can relate. I think that makes a sort of perfect segue to talking about this whole idea of, you know, fame for its own sake. But what has been the trajectory that led you into filmmaking, you know, post high school, college, all of that? How did you end up here?
Sure. I was going to go to law school like my father, like I mentioned earlier, out of college. And I was in Washington, D.C., interning for Eric Holder, who was the U.S. attorney under Obama prior to then. And I was just, that's where I was going. And then I went and see this double feature in DC, and it was Shawshank Redemption and Pulp Fiction, two very seminal films at the time. And, you know, something about those themes of hope and redemption and justice and in the Shawshank Redemption, and then just the style and the panache of Pulp Fiction. I was a Tarantino fan already, and I was like, you know what, I want to do this. Like, so I came, and I've always wanted to be an actor, and I did it a lot as a kid. So I came to Hollywood and I started doing acting gigs and TV and commercials and film, and I was loving it and still do love it. I think of myself as an actor first and foremost, and I want to continue doing that, but the business has changed so much since those like films, those independent films of the 90s really, you know, I think gravitate a lot of people to LA wanting to do something of a similar ilk. And as I kept doing acting gigs, I started playing music and then released an album, and I was like, oh, I love this too. Okay, what do I do? So then I was kind of at a crossroads, you know, I wasn't getting out for the bigger roles, which I wish I had, which is, you know, a lot of people's story here in LA. And I said, well, what am I going to do? So I wrote a script, and I wanted to, you know, the old joke, well, I really want to do is direct. But I mean, I really did want to direct something. I've been watching all these independent films and directors, and I'm like, I can do this. I've been on set. I know what's going on. I think I can do this. And it was really about stepping into myself as an adult from that kid who had been kind of wounded. Like, it was like trusting myself, you know? And I think directing for me was very important because it allowed me to like trust myself as a kid, where I felt like, you know, trust myself as an adult. Whereas as a child, I was like the same way as an adult as I was then, in terms of like wearing a lot of hats, but you know, there was still that wound. And it's just like, I want to step into my shoes. I want to have the final say, and I trust that I'll be able to do this. And there were a lot of times where I was on independent films where I'd see them move on from a scene that wasn't done. I'm like, oh, the film's screwed, because if we don't have that scene, we're done. But other people who were behind, you know, the producer or director couldn't see it. And I know it's such an inexact science making a film. So I wanted to put myself in that position, and I'm so glad I did. So I started writing the songs as if they were scenes in the film, and then writing the script and recording the songs as like with the tempos and the, you know, and the songs like rough tracks in the studio. And then the script, that whole process took about 2 years. And I don't know how I made it upon reflection, but it was like one of those things where if you have to make a film, whether you want to or not, if it's part of your fate, whether you've got the money or not, or whether you have the time or not, it will like take you over. Like I was working with superhuman strength. So if you like gave me like $10 million and told me to make the Golden Age again, there's no way I could do it again. I could make another film, but I couldn't make that one again because it was like, it was almost like a purging, you know, like a boil that needed to get lanced. It was tough. So moving to directing made a lot of sense. And then I'm not a really big fan of musicals per se, but I don't like how in musicals there's lip syncing. So I said, well, why don't we make a musical? Let's get deep on your own past as well as where you're headed next on the devotional path. Let's see if we can do an album about this. Let's try to spin the oeuvre and do something that's kind of narrative, kind of documentary, and we're not really sure what it is. And let's get really honest, you know, and that's where it all kind of came from. And I don't know how it came to fruition. And I worked on this for years and years and years, but I'm so pleased with how it's turned out. You know, I'm so yeah. pleased with it.
So I think that all of us in our lives have that sort of moment of seeing that sort of double future, you know, where it's one road versus the other. And I wonder why you think it is that so often people don't choose the one they want, but choose the one that they need to do, or choose the thing they think they fear. Should do. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's fear. I think it's hard to, and this is why I think I look up to a lot of iconoclasts, like, you know, like Bob Dylan and Harry Nilsson and George Harrison and John Lennon and all these musicians who kind of march to the beat of their own drum, you know, like they're iconoclasts. Like they were singing about stuff that not many people were. Same thing with filmmakers. We could go down the list. You know, lately I've been like obsessed with Dave Chappelle for some reason. He's a brilliant stand-up, but the reason I'm so obsessed with him lately is not only how good he is, but how original he is. It's like he's storytelling and then nailing you with the punchline, but being poignant while he does it. It's like I'm really drawn to these people that are like, hell or high water, I'm going to do something unique and no one else may get it but me. And that's okay. Yeah. And that takes a certain bravery, you know? And I was at a crossroads in terms of, do I want to march to the beat of the drum that everyone else here is in town? I'm like, no, I don't. And that's fearful because I can already see like there's elements of the Golden Age and there's a lot of double entendres in it. And there's a lot of devotional fodder in it that maybe the zeitgeist or where the society is right now in terms of some of the lyrics are seeing Maya as a metaphor for the illusory energy of the material age. Like it's a satire on so many different levels that I'm not saying like the culture maybe isn't hip enough to get it right now, but the zeitgeist is kind of entrenched in that whole idea of being known in social media right now that it's like there's elements that it might go over people's heads right now. But I know this is going to catch it. It's already is catching on with a lot of people right now, but a lot of devotees are spiritualists. But it may be something that will just continue to gravitate and grow. But I had to trust that even if it meant I was going to alienate some people or maybe they weren't going to get it. Or this is like, wait a minute, what is this film about? Or is this real? And what's funny about when I released the film, like people who I don't know, as well as people who I do, everyone's so entrenched in wanting to know what's real and fake with the film. And that kind of style of partly narrative, partly documentary. And it's funny to me because we're so interested in this like salacious storytelling or storylines of like Twitter and what's going on in culture. Like everyone wants to know, what did she say or what happened there? Like they want to know the real nitty gritty of it. And I kind of wanted to take, you know, the wind out of the sails of how entrenched we become in other people's lives as like what's real and what's fake. And it's almost like sometimes I feel like our culture is very gossipy. I'm like, well, if we're going to get gossipy or we're going to get kind of weird about like what's happening, I'm going to create this character. But instead of making it fictitious and satirizing it in a comedic light, I'm going to satirize it and look at my own stuff, but get really honest with it and not be coy about it. And I think at the end of the day, when people ask me what it's about, I still think the Golden Age is a comedy, but it's not a comedy that's like trying to make you laugh. You know, because sometimes when you're watching a comedy, you know that the laugh is coming. So you're kind of like on your, you know, at the edge of your seat waiting for when it's time to laugh. But the Golden Age is kind of like a wink, wink. Are you in on the joke comedy? It's like a satire that doesn't hit you unless you're hip to the game. So yeah, that's kind of where it's all coming from right now. And I feel like I had to do something to honor all those iconoclastic artists that like just hit me so deep, because I know they were doing something at the time. People were like, this is crazy. You know, you why don't you do this instead, like a romantic comedy, or why don't you do this thing, which would be a little smarter, or do a TV show of 10 part series instead of this, or whatever it is. And I really admire people that say, I'm going to do this, as well as all the people that we don't know that are doing that aren't famous or haven't been discovered, that are doing really compelling work, whether it's writers or poets or artists or whatever. I think, you know, there's a certain like wanting to refrain from what everyone else is doing and really honoring what you know deepest in your core you have to do, or else you'll go far madder than had you not taken it on at all. So I think that's where it came about for me.
Yeah, it's interesting for you to bring up this whole idea of fame and marching to the beat of your own drum, because my last book that I did with a publisher was called An Audience of One: Reclaiming Creativity for Its Own Sake. Uh-huh. And we opened the book with the story of Daft Punk. You know, one of the things I said is, in a culture that basically is obsessed with attention, you have two guys who basically have chosen to intentionally make themselves more and more anonymous as their work has become more and more known. And,
I know, totally. It's a great reference. Jeez.
Yeah. And I think that to me is really kind of an interesting jump off point for us to kind of dive deeper into this whole idea of fame, because, you know, why do you think that we have this sort of obsession with this idea of fame? Because I think you pointed out, which funny enough will probably be the title of our interview, is that this isn't going to heal our wounds. I can tell you, I wrote a Wall Street Journal bestseller and the problems in my life didn't go away. In fact, I was probably more insecure after that than I was before. But I think there's this idea that we have. And I remember Josh Ratner was on Sam Jones' podcast off camera, and he said that, you know, if you're not grounded, a career in the arts is rigged for dissatisfaction, totally. Which really stayed with me. And so I wonder, one, why do you think this is? Like, why are we so obsessed with this idea? What are the really negative consequences of it? And, you know, what are the positives of letting go of that need for validation from the external world, particularly when it comes to creative work?
Oh my God, such good questions, man. Yeah. Well, let me first say, and thank you for the Daft Punk reference. And I wasn't necessarily familiar with their work, but I knew of them. And I'm sure you've seen the documentary on them, yeah?
Yeah, that was why we did it. Because I remember, you know, I was with a friend in Colombia. We're trying to figure out what the introduction to my book was going to be. My friend said, hey, come down to Colombia. Let's hang out for a week. And so I went there and we watched this documentary. And I said, that's it. That's the story. That's the story we'll open the book with. And because it was the crazy thing, the two things that really struck me about that story were, when they got the first record deal, they were meeting with record executives from Virgin, and the record executives showed up in a limo to pick them up. And they said, we don't want to be seen getting into a limo. We'll take the subway and we'll meet you at the restaurant, when they did Coachella, which that was insane, like that it went viral on YouTube, instead of actually keeping any of the money for themselves, they literally spent all of it on the production.
Totally. I love that. That's no, I remember the documentary hit me too, dude. What a great reference. Thank you for that. That's a great metaphor to jump off on. Well, first of all, those guys, you know, watching that was very humbling for me. And there are stories like that. Searching for Sugar Man, Sisto Rodriguez. I don't know if you heard of that one.
That's I've definitely heard of that one. Yeah.
Yeah. And he's like, you know, kind of like just fell out of the limelight after doing like a couple of studio albums. And there's a lot of like interesting artists, Scott Walker, 30th Century Man, you know, a lot of about these profiles, about these idiosyncratic artists that kind of shy away from the limelight or for whatever reason, good, bad, or indifferent. But, you know, I'm on the same page as Daft Punk with that. I think what we're going to see over the next decade or two, if not longer, if not shorter, is people refraining from it all and doing a strong body of work. And then you find out about them later and be like, holy crap, because it's a very mad age right now in terms of people running around doing whatever they can to be famous. And my Daft Punk version was, I wanted to make Maya O'Malley, the lead protagonist, famous. And the people that don't know me that watch the film start Wikipedia and after, and like, how come I've never heard of this guy and they can't find out anything on them? And it's almost like that's the comedy of the golden age, is how entrenched people now want to know, how come I didn't hear about this guy? It's almost like a play on the play within the play itself. I would be more interested in making him famous than I would even myself, because it seems like everyone who achieves this type of notoriety on some level can't help but go crazy, because there's no place to go but down once this happens. And I think Daft Punk was very aware of that. Yeah. And, you know, there's this term in the East, and one of my gurus talk about, it's called Pratishtha. And Pratishtha is the Hindi word for like name and fame and worldly prestige. And they talk about it. And this one guru, Srila Srinam Maharaj, he's so deep. He like talks about, Pratishtha is that's the last stage before true surrender on the devotional path. Like that's the last snare or crosshair of Maya, or like that which seeks to take us away from our devotion, is this need to wanting to be known. And it's not even like really famous per se. I mean, you could live in an ashram and still have that. Well, I want to be the head cook. You know, it's like that whole ego, that egoic, like I want, you know, what I deserve, or I want to show my talents, or I want, like that whole thing. It's like, it's beautiful. It's a wonderful display to show your creative talents and have people revel in it and work in it. I'm not like adverse to that, but there is a flip side to that. If you're not detached from the fruits and rewards of your labor, you know, like if you're not attached to, you know, the outcome in a way that we're so taught to can't help but enjoy or be craving on some level. So in terms of like the negative consequences of all of this, I think, I don't know. I think the people who I really relate to, you know, it's so funny you mentioned that Daft Punk, because that documentary hit me so hard. But there's so many people that I look up to that they're wise enough to see that that's a ruse. And I think the negative consequences are everyone is chasing this one thing. Or not this one thing, but everyone wants to be known. I'd be lying if I said I don't have it myself.
No.
You know what I mean? The golden age, I want the whole world to see it. And I believe in it, not because I had anything to do with it. I just think it's a strong piece of work. In the same way someone else's album or someone's painting is, like, I'll tell people, like, you got to see this. It's amazing. Or a film or something. But it's not like, I think when you can get to where you're working as an artist and you're so entrenched in what you're doing and can stand behind it in the way those iconoclastic directors or whoever can say, yeah, I did it and I trust this. And if it was just for me, then that's enough. Because it's so beyond the ego in terms of what we're doing. And the reality of the whole creative game is when we're really connected, we're really acting like a conduit or a puppet to something that's much greater than ourselves, in terms of like being like a channel through whatever divinity or the universe or divine inspiration, etc. But I think the negative consequences comes in because I just think it has the potential to ruin so many people, and we see how many it does. So I think the trend in the next 10 or 20 years is going to be people that completely shy away from this and just do a complete body of work, and then we find out about them later. And we already can know, it's already happening. Like people are like, hey, there's this singer-songwriter from the 60s, 70s, you heard of them? And it's like, you know, there were people that were kind of hip to this game earlier than what we're discussing right now. But I think this age-old thing of you are how well you're known is very prominent right now. But I think it's going to become a ruse down the road. I think it's almost going to be embarrassing if it continues to happen to the extent it does, because there's so many people that are listened to in front of a microphone that, pardon my pun, but I don't think they're like necessarily qualified to be, but it doesn't matter. It only matters if you're being, you know, if you got a bunch of people, a bunch of followers or a bunch of likes or a bunch of movement behind you, but that doesn't mean it's necessarily compelling at that which you're doing, if at all, you know? So I think it's a very funny time of our existence. And I think following the credo of people like Daft Punk, I mean, or, you know, all these different iconoclastic artists, some of which we don't even know of and may never know of. I think there's as much beauty in that as there is in this idea of becoming known for our creations, because we know at the core of our being, whether we're entrenched in this business or not, the upside isn't what we've convinced itself we think it is, you know?
Yeah. It's funny you say that because, you know, my roommate and I often have, you know, talks about this. I'm just like, yeah, I want millions of people to listen to Unmistakable Creative. And at the same time, I would be okay if none of them had a clue who I was. I would, in fact, prefer that. I would rather them know nothing about me and only know about my work.
It's kind of a relief. And the thing that's interesting about Daft Punk and Bob Dylan and all these people from, you know, from a different generation that are like, oh, wow, they're really marching the beat of their own drum. We knew nothing about them because the channels were fairly restricted where we couldn't really know much about them. Obviously, with Dylan, we knew more about, like, oh, he was dating this person. He went to, you know, upstate New York to record this, you know, like, but we didn't really know that much. And now in this day and age, it's like, it's almost like you can't be known if you don't reveal it all. And even if you do reveal it all, you've got to self-market yourself to death, which is something that most artists cannot do, myself included, are not really built for that. Like, I'm a creator. I'm not really looking to, like, market myself. And the people who are very successful, I think, successful in this day and age, market themselves pretty well, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're talented at that, which they do.
Yeah.
So I think, you know what I mean?
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I've said it before. I've said, look, there's people who can build massive audiences because they're great marketers, and publishers will literally give them a book deal. And if that author is like, hey, I want to print a book with, you know, pictures of my face on it that people can use as toilet paper to wipe their asses, people, like, a publisher will be like, yeah, we can sell that.
Of course. Well, you know what? In my opinion, there's going to be a downside to all this. There's going to be a grand reckoning. And if you can't see the mirage of material life of that, which it will continue to reflectively imbue upon our lens, whether we like it or not, there's a downside to all this. And I say God bless to all those people that have their big followers and are always online. But it's like, I'm more interested in creating art. And sometimes I see all these people doing this for like 5 and 10 years, and they have all these followers and they're selling some poorly written book or whatever they're doing. But it's like, in 10 years, it's going to be like, what did I create? Just a lot of like self spin about myself or interesting Instagram stories. Like, I don't know. It just seems like there's going to be a downside or a reckoning to all this. So my job personally as an artist feels like just to follow the lead of, you know, the credo of someone like Daft Punk. I just think it's genius what they did. They just wanted to hold their masters and create what they wanted to do. And I think that's all you really want to do, is just do something that's so unique to what's going on and what's so unique and honoring yourself. And I think there's going to be a reckoning. I mark my words, in like 10 or 20 years, it's almost going to be embarrassing. And there's a lot of celebrities now that were once celebrities in the 80s. I was listening to Rob Lowe talk on, I think it was Joe Rogan, and he was saying, you know, who the hell would want to be famous now? It's like, you can't go anywhere. Like, if we were going out and partying like we were back in the day and there was the paparazzi, we'd be dead. We wouldn't have had careers. Yep. And I think there's an element of like, you know, I don't think anybody wants to. I think the ones who have had their brush with it are kind of staying on the sidelines a little bit, because you can't even say anything now without like, you know?
Yep. Trust me, I can relate to some degree, having had a brief moment on reality TV. So, but I think that really does make just a beautiful and really thought-provoking way to wrap up our conversation. So I have one final question for you, which is how we finish all of our interviews. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
I think it's, I think you know, when we have those moments in life when we go up and down and we look ourselves in the mirror and be like, where am I at? What am I doing? I think what makes it unmistakable is, you know, what we've talked about throughout this episode is, sometimes we have to trust that which it is we're creating or offering or serving is so ingrained with that which we have to share or create or, you know, expose to the masses, regardless of whether anyone understands it but us. Even if that audience could just be that one person, are we willing to do that versus do what we know maybe our parents want us to do, or our boyfriend or girlfriend or wife, or something that society will deem more acceptable? Like, I really respond to those that can unmistakably follow their own path, hell or high water, regardless of what anybody thinks about them, whether anyone even gets it except themselves. Like, are they still willing to proceed? And those that continue to say, yes, that's what I'm going to do, like, I applaud them to the ends of the earth. And that is the fame that I'm looking for, because that is its own, like, meritocracy in terms of like a weight. It's a weight. It's a currency that extends far beyond money, that extends far beyond followers. That's really stepping into the shoes of a role that you know is so deeply ingrained in your soul that no one may ever understand, butt you potentially, and you're still willing to walk through it, that's what I'm looking for. And I think that's the unmistakable part of creativity that I hope more people are inspired to carry out for themselves.
Wow. This has been really, truly amazing and beautiful.
Yeah, same, man.
I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your wisdom, your story, and insights with our listeners. Where can people find out more about you, your work, and everything else that you're up to in the world?
Sure. The Golden Age by Justin Connor. It's a film on Amazon Prime. The reviews have been outstanding. Go check it out. If you have an Amazon Prime account, it's free. The album, Justin Connor, The Golden Age, is on all streaming platforms. The book is entitled A Day and the Lies, and that's going to be released on all fine bookstores and Amazon by Christmas. And you'll be able to get a hardbound signed copy at justinconnor.com by the same time at the end of the year. And you can keep in touch with me on social media. I am Justin Connor. And yeah.
Incredible.
I'd love to connect with people. You know, what's happening just real quick is people have been seeing the film that have been through some of their own traumas. They're really healing from watching The Golden Age. So for some of your listeners who have been through the ringer themselves, you're definitely going to want to take a check at it, because people are coming to me saying I went through the same thing or having similar iterations, and it's by proxy healing some of their own healing process and fostering like their own stuff that maybe they haven't looked at. So anybody who's been through the ringer and walked through their fire, I think The Golden Age is up your alley.
Amazing. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member, who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolved. We're talking about real differentiators here, like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.